Welcome to Make It Simple, where we take complicated issues and with the help of an expert, break them down into ideas we can understand, truths we can apply, and questions worth pondering. I'm your host, Matt Popovitz, and with me, as always, is my friend and co-host, Rachel Ryder. Rachel, we get to talk about the Bible today. How does that make you feel?
You know, I'm really excited about this one. So often we talk about issues and topics, and today we're talking about this thing that I think a lot of us think we're super familiar with, but are we really? You know, how much do we really know about the Old Testament?
Yeah, and I know it's a pretty broad subject, but
right.
we have a great expert to walk us through it. Miss Sarah Salzberg is an expert on the Old Testament, and I think I'm free to say expert. She teaches this stuff every single day to the right. most difficult of audiences in the world. She teaches the Old Testament to skeptical high school students. So what better expert can we have than that? Someone who's able to like communicate this and make it simple to high school students, right?
Right. For sure. You know, and when it comes to the Old Testament, I think you and I have very similar upbringings. Like I grew up in a Christian tradition. I went to private school. We had Bible class and all of that. So there's a part of me that if I'm not careful, will go, I know the Old Testament. I got it. I've heard it. I know it's weird. It's crazy. But I also know I don't know. It's so rich and it's so beautiful and it's poetic and it's crazy. And so I love the idea of hearing from somebody who is really passionate and knowledgeable about this to really, you know, hear what does the Old Testament mean to people today?
Yeah, I mean, it's 39 books in the Old Testament, mm-hmm. Tons of different types of literature represented in the Old Testament. It covers thousands of years mm-hmm. in its writing and, over the time and of course, time in which it represents and in which it was collected. So, I mean, it's big and it's complicated, it's diverse. And yet, I think Sarah can help us wrap our minds around what the message of the Old Testament is as a whole and what the mm-hmm. purpose of it is for modern people and for people, especially you know, people of faith today. So a little bit about Sarah. I've known her for years, worked with her on various projects, and I'm always just taken aback by her humor and her quirkiness, but also her wisdom. Sarah lives in Los Angeles, California, with her husband Josh and their two kids. She teaches Old Testament at Orange Lutheran High School in Orange County, California. She speaks all over the place, helping people understand God's Word, in particular the Old Testament. This is how great she is. She can even make the Old Testament book of Leviticus fascinating and hope-filled for you, which just speaks to her wisdom and her awesomeness as a presenter and speaker. And so I am delighted that we get to talk to her today and that our audience gets to meet her. Rachel, what are you hoping to get out of this conversation?
You know, you ask me that every week, and so I should be prepared, but This is one of those times, like, I don't know. I don't have any expectations. I just want to learn. I want to hear from somebody who's excited about this, and I love the nerdy side of the Bible, like I love that part of it as well, and so I'm just excited to hear from her, and I want to know what I don't know, and I would like to leave this conversation with fresh eyes for the Old Testament.
Oh, I think it's a great way to put it, fresh eyes for the Old Testament. I want to know how she gets high school students to care about this. That's what I want to know, because certainly if she can get high school students to care about it, then she can get us to care about it and understand it. So let's waste no more time. Let's dive right into our conversation about the Old Testament. We're going to make it simple with Sarah Salzberg. Let's start at the most foundational level. Like, what are we talking about when we talk about the Old Testament?
Sure. I actually try to call it Hebrew Bible. We don't call it that at my school. We call it Old Testament, but I like to respect that this has a heritage longer than we as Christians have given it a name. So when I think about that, I kind of first and foremost want to understand what did Jesus believe about the scriptures that I'm reading and how did he use them? And what was kind of the overarching, not just the like telos, not just the end goal of what the Hebrew Bible is sharing, but also the process by which he read it. So I think that when we talk about, if we're going to use Old Testament, we can use that. That's fine. But when we talk about the Old Testament, just understanding that the literature that is this messianic promise of what we see Christ to be the fulfillment of, and yet also acknowledging that too often we treat maybe the Old Testament like it's a waiting game, like God was just buying time until Jesus came along. And rather than doing that, seeing that the God is kind of over and over and over again telling the same story, so that when Christ busts on the scene and we see his death and resurrection, we go, oh, that's the same story as Abraham and Isaac. That's the same story as the Passover. That's the same story as God in the tabernacle. And so kind of realizing that, even I just was telling my students, I think Genesis 1 is actually a summary of the entire storyline of the Bible. And they look at me like I'm crazy. And then we spend 7 weeks in it and they're like, wait, yeah, you could totally get Jesus just from reading this. That's kind of more my understanding of when I talk about the Old Testament. All of these stories are kind of stories within stories, all a part of a big story. But if I want to understand the big story, I have to go all the way down to each little story, which is why we got tons of time to study it, like a whole lifetime.
So if you had to quickly summarize, what is that one big story that God's telling over and over and over again in the Old Testament? Yeah. What would you say that is?
I think that, well, I come from a faith tradition that we tend to have one kind of predominant gospel metaphor that we really like. And it really makes sense coming out of the Reformation that we want people to understand that their status before God is guilty because of sin, but then because of Jesus, they're forgiven. It's a great, totally in scripture, not against it. Think it's fantastic. I have a really hard time with that being the like sole message, only because that's not really the visual picture that's in the Old Testament. And so when I talk about what is the like the one story I see that's over and over and over again is God's desire to be present with humanity. And that presence with humanity means it requires him to graciously give of himself so that we can be present with him. And namely in the Old Testament, certainly we see that in the form of sacrifice. But even that concept of sacrifice that I think a lot of Christians are familiar with sometimes gets made into this legalistic thing, like, oh, we have to give something to God so that he'll be pleased with us. And it's almost this like commercial trait. Whereas I look at it and say, well, God's desire to be present with us, he totally says that I will accept this in place of you, but not as some kind of, so I'm not mad at you, but more as a, I can be present with you. And so I say the story that happens over and over and over again is God actively working to be present with his people at the cost to himself. Which then of course, how easy is it to see the word becoming flesh and at the cost to himself in order to be present with us, he takes our place and dies. Right. So yeah,
no,
still not
beautiful.
Simple.
No, that is simple and it's beautiful. So then my next question then is, if Christ is the ultimate fulfillment of that story of God's desire to be present with his people at great cost to himself, what role does the Old Testament play in Christian theology and practice today? Now that Christ has come and he has lived and died and risen, and that ultimate version of the story has appeared. What relevance then does the Old Testament have now then?
Well, I think the simplest answer to that is just that you can't possibly understand what Jesus is saying to any of the people that he's speaking to in the Gospels if you don't have the background of like, what are they referencing or those kind of things. And that's just, I mean, that even be as simple as, you know, when you read the Gospel of Matthew or Mark, where he's just referencing verses from the Old Testament. But I think a gospel like John, oh man, do you like, we were just talking about, cause I'm doing the story of creation. And a kid brought up, they were like, wait, the spirit was hovering over the waters. So like, well, I was told it was ex, like God created everything ex nihilo. And they had this whole like, that's wrong. And I was like, well, that's their concept of nothing might be water. But he was like, but if it says the water is, or the spirit is hovering over the waters, do you think that's why Jesus told Nicodemus that a person should be born of water and the spirit? And I was like, what? Like, you're 17 and you figured out that like beautiful little nugget that is in there that you wouldn't have known had you not read intensely the Old Testament. Or things like if you read you know, Paul is Jewish, like Peter, they're Jewish. So if we don't understand their background, then how can we see the like nuances of what they're saying? Like, there's all these beautiful little hyperlinks in Paul's letters. And again, my faith tradition, we love Paul. We think Paul was the first one of us. But if we don't see when he like just plants a word in there that is actually hearkening back to the Exodus story, like if he ever puts redemption in there, like, ooh, that is a tasty little treat for me, because I'm like, oh, what about this passage is actually connecting us to the Old Testament story of the Exodus. So like, even just on those base level things, it's certainly important that we know it. But I also think as Christians, if we aren't willing to acknowledge that, well, I think more Christians need to have friends that are non-Christians. And it bothers me how often I meet people that are not, they don't know anyone who's not Christian. So how could you possibly know the world that God's called us to live in, but also where people have issue with it? And I talk about this with my students all the time. I'm like, most people don't have issue with Jesus, right? Like in their mind, this guy's walking on rainbows and like telling everybody to be nice to each other. But look at how the Old Testament is used against people, right? The Old Testament is seen as this completely different character than Jesus. And I think what happens then is actually we take all of the justice out of Jesus too, because we're like, well, we need to make him look real different from the God of the Old Testament. So we'll take all the stuff where Jesus is saying the like, hey, I got some hard law for you. And we take that away because we want him to look real pretty to the outside. But then I don't think a lot of Christians know how to, I hate saying defend, like God needs our defense, but to defend God's actions in the Old Testament, because they actually don't know who he is. And I'd even go so far as to say, I think Christians should read all the Old Testament. I think everybody should read the Old Testament. It's the sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It's the way more fun. No offense, Jesus. But even just reading Genesis 1-3, we don't spend enough time in that. Like that's the introduction, like being a lit person, right? And Matt, you do theater. So you get the opening scene. Like we need to, if that is not well written, if that is not well done, then we're not going to get the nuances later. But also, if I don't understand who God is in those opening chapters, right, his character's on full display and we get to see kind of his motivation for doing things. But when we get to passages much later, God's going to do stuff and not reveal his intentions. And we either fill in the gaps and pretend like we know what's happening, or we go, okay, I don't know why he's doing that, but I know who he is because I've read Genesis 1-3. I know his character. I know he's a God who loves and he's a God who creates. He's a God who has purpose. He's a God who likes humanity. So he can't just be doing this because he hates us. Like it's not a Bruce Almighty image, right?
So you can't understand the heart of God apart from the Old Testament, especially those first three chapters of Genesis. You can't understand Jesus apart from the Old Testament. You can't understand the whole of the New Testament apart from the Old, right? So it's critical for that. So that's how Christian people use it. That's why it's essential for us. But you mentioned the context of Jesus and the context of Paul and Peter, the earliest Christians. They were Jewish. They had a working understanding of the Old Testament. What was the role of what we call the Old Testament for a first century Jew? How did they see these books?
Well, I think it's important that we acknowledge that we're not a monolith. The Christian church has never been a monolith. So even at the time, right, that it wasn't as though everybody was in agreement at the time of Jesus for how we should use it, right? There are plenty of disagreements. And we tend to focus on like, oh, the Sadducees and the Pharisees or like those kind of nuances. But I think in general, I think understanding that it was used to know their identity, who are they? And so the repeating of the stories, right? That they had a similar to Christian faith traditions today, they would go through the cycle of reading the story and being familiar with it, or they'd read certain psalms based on where we were in the kind of year of reading it or whatever festival was being celebrated, and just understanding that their faith was not in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. I think that that also comes down to something that American Christians can't really understand in our own culture. We have to actively work against our culture in this way, but we live in such a me society that everything is about me, versus the Hebrew understanding, the Jewish understanding is a we society. And I always use this with my students because they'll get mad like when the Israelites get punished, but only one person did something wrong. And I was like, if I came in here and like one kid was like being disrespectful and I yelled at all of you and said, you're all going to the office. I was like, what would you all say? And they're like, I didn't do anything wrong. And I was like, yeah, because you think I'm only responsible for my actions. They understand that they're collectively together. And obviously you see that as a negative thing in this instance, but it's also what makes it so beautiful because 1,000 years after the Exodus, they're going to say things like, Yahweh delivered me out of Egypt, even though they never lived there, because they understand that that's their identity. And then they can also sub in like, what are the Egypts that we have? Hmm. I think that also helps you understand why they have such an aggression towards Rome. Like in the New Testament, right, when we see when Jesus butts up against these religious leaders, and in their mind, he seems to be siding with Rome. They don't see him siding with Rome. They see him siding with Babylon and with Egypt and these oppressive nations in the past. Because again, all of this is one story. And so for a New Testament reader or maybe a Jewish audience in the New Testament time period, they are looking at Jesus as, what are you saying that lines up with what we've heard before and not? Mm-hmm. Which is why I'm never shocked that, like, I tell my students, I'm like, I feel like if I was a Pharisee, as soon as I was bothered by this prophet that came, I'd be like, wait a second. We did the same thing with Jeremiah. Like, I feel like we've been here before. Like, that's the only thing that doesn't line up for me is I was like, guys, you're living the same story you keep reading about.
Yeah. But, how do they not pick up on that pattern, right?
Yeah. 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 It's all over the place, dudes. Whatever.
Well, one of the things
might have preached to them.
Well, but one of the things people, you know, have heard, if even if they have, you know, really little exposure to the Old Testament itself, but have some exposure to the Christian faith, is this idea, and you mentioned it earlier, that there that Jesus is the Messiah, and that the Old mm-hmm. Testament has these messianic themes that, in a sense, the Old Testament points to or predicts the arrival of Jesus. What do we mean? What do Christian people mean when they talk about the Old Testament speaking of predicting, pointing to Jesus as Messiah?
Sure. Well, now we're getting into the nerdy portion of the podcast.
Let's go there.
So I will say a lot of times when people talk about that, they think that the Old Testament is just this like, the term for it is rectilinear prophecy. And man, does that sound gross. So I like to say it. But just the idea that we tend to focus on the passages in the Old Testament where there is just a singular prophecy with a singular fulfillment. So like, he's going to be born of a virgin. That happens one time. He's going to be born in Bethlehem. That happens one time. And those are great, but that's like 5 or 6% of the Old Testament. It's not very much. It tends to be what we read, right? It's what we read during Lent, getting ready for Easter. It's what we read during Advent, getting ready for Christmas. Yeah. But the concept more has to do with, what are called typological prophecies. So that is the understanding that there are those patterns, like we were talking about. Abraham goes on a mountain ready to sacrifice his one and only son. Hmm. And Yahweh intercedes and says, here, take a ram instead, right? And we go, oh, that's just like Jesus, the one and only son of the Father. And also Jesus is the lamb who steps the place of we Isaacs. And so those are those kind of typological stories where you read a story and you go, oh, that's kind of like Jesus. And understanding that, yes, that is predicting a greater Isaac, right? A greater son, or to use one that Jesus uses himself, right? You read the story of Jonah and you're like, okay, well, Jonah's the worst human being on the planet. So I'm not glorifying this guy. But the Jesus side of the Jonah story is that Jonah is asked to go to a city that we should expect to not receive his message. And he does. And the people repent. Huzzah. Oh, by the way, it all happens after he was in a fish for 3 days and then is spit out, right? And Jesus says, oh, that's me. I'm the one. I'm going to spend 3 days, not in a fish. I'm going to be dead. And I'm going to be not vomited. I'm going to raise from the dead. And so you read those stories and you go, he's the greater Jonah. Mm-hmm. He's the greater David. He's the greater Moses. And each one of those stories kind of showing us that. But then there's also just kind of, and I think this is maybe the part where I'm really getting more into, because it's not something I was taught explicitly, is understanding, as you pointed out earlier, like the character of God that's on display in the Old Testament and how those character pieces are hinting at a Messiah. God in the flesh being that character in human form. And so simple things like knowing that, right, God is this overwhelmingly patient, who is persistently with his people, who is for the outcast, who is for the other, who is for the nations. Like, we were looking, right now I'm teaching about Sabbath, and I just show the Sabbath law. I'm like, cool, you guys all, when you think of Sabbath law, you just think 6 days they work and the seventh day they rest. But let's look at like the nuances of it. And we read who gets to celebrate. And I said, there should be three groups in there that are kind of odd to you. Well, the livestock rest, because we don't have any kind view of our role in creation, right? Mm-hmm. Like, give them a break. They're not there to be your workhorses all the time.
Yeah.
But then the second group that they immediately point out is the servants, right? That the slaves get to eat at the Passover meal. I was like, yeah. Mm-hmm. They do eat Passover, but at the Sabbath meal. And I said, how crazy would that have been in the ancient Near East world? Like, if I was an Israelite slave at the well, and I'm talking to a Canaanite slave, and I said, hey, I got to get going because sun's about to go down and I got to get back for Sabbath. What would the Canaanite slave expect my job to be at Sabbath? To be the workhorse, to just take care of everybody. And I'm like, oh, no, I get to sit at the table. I was like, what does that say about the Messiah? What does that say about the Sabbath rest he has, right? He is the God that brings in those. Like, there isn't a system of oppression, right? And then there's also the sojourner, right? A traveler, but perhaps non-Israel. Like, there's no place for xenophobia in Yahweh's system, right? That tells me something about God's character that then I see in Christ. So that when Christ is reaching out to the lepers, when Christ is reaching out to those that would have been seen as less than, I shouldn't be shocked. That's who God is. So of course the Messiah is that way.
Yeah. And so like when the writer of Hebrews in the New Testament says that Christ is our Sabbath rest, we have a much better understanding of what that means. You know, he's the one who brings the feast to all people, right? He's the one who brings not only rest for our souls, but justice and equal treatment and so much more for all people. Yeah.
So, and it's funny because when I say that in class, like sometimes kids will think, like, I know they're wanting it to be like, oh, she's being political. I'm like, I'm not though. Like, I'm literally just reading what the text says. And it's funny how, because the Old Testament has been used that way, that they can't, I don't know. It's hard to break that down and to say, oh, I just have to read what's there and then follow that through. And sometimes it's really a lot to digest because that does impact my everyday life. Mm-hmm. Like, it does change the way that I operate with every interaction every day. If I'm reading what God's character says, it does change how I interact. Not because I'm afraid that God's going to hate me if I don't, because I hate when it gets dwindled down to legalism, but it is just, it's a changing, it's a forming, it's a shaping of me that I never got until I really studied the Old Testament.
Yeah. So, well, let's talk about that impact on everyday life, because, you know, so far you've told us some really great things that the Old Testament, of course, has all of these kind of shadows and hints that point towards Jesus. It's also the story of God's desire to be with humanity at great cost to himself, told over and over again in many different ways. It's essential to understanding Jesus. It's essential to understanding, of course, the New Testament. It's this place where we see the character and heart of God on display. But here's my question.
You're a great salesman for the Old Testament. If we could just bottle that and just put that was great. We'll do that.
Well, thanks. I stole it all from you. So thank you.
It simple.
Hey, that's the goal. That's the goal.
That's it.
But then my question is, all that's great in kind of a philosophical and theological sense. Is there any is there any practical, like everyday value that we can draw out of the Old Testament? Not to say that understanding the character of God is not practical and have everyday value, but I think you know what I mean. Like, is there anything I can go, anything I can get for helping me navigate my day to day at school, at church, or you know, out in the marketplace that I can draw from what's given to me in the words of the Old Testament?
Sure. I'm going to answer that in two different lights. So I think one practicality, just as a Christian in my everyday life, is that the simplest thing about all this, like it's meditative literature. Psalm 1 says that we meditate on it, and that word is chaga, and it's like a cow chewing cud. So it's just like you're chewing something, you swallow it. Sorry to be gross, but you vomit it back up and chew on it again. And like, that's the process. And I think sometimes we get scared of reading the Old Testament because I'm, quote, not going to get it. Or they think that I'm on here and this is just what I've always known, as opposed to this has been 15 years in the making. And that's just my professional career, not even my own life. So I do think like the practicality of it for a Christian is just every time you read, be in the reading. And take the time to slow down and know that there's not one right answer when you read any of these stories. Because sometimes the idea that all of these are pointing to Jesus, maybe that's a good start. But then the end result sometimes is that as soon as I figure out how it connects to Jesus, then like, get the hell out of there. Yeah. And I think the reality is I literally spend every day reading Genesis 1, trying to figure out what more does this mean? And so kind of the practicality there is just read it and ask questions and be okay that you don't always have the answer right away. But also know that there's going to be more to chew on and dig in. And so ask the questions and then kind of follow that rabbit hole and see what happens. And not everything comes back roses, but some things do. And it's kind of cool to see that. I think from a practicality though, in my, how that lives out in my life is when I understand how God's operating, then it unfortunately means that while we sometimes want the laws that God gives us to be very black and white and cut and dry and super easy, right? Like, you guys talk a lot with people about, what are seen as political issues, right? And a lot of Christians are looking for the Bible to tell them that there's one right way that we should be voting on these matters. And there's one right way that Congress could be doing this right. And so we just have to figure out that one right way. And then we just push that through every legislature possible. Mm-hmm. And I found that the world's a little bit more gray than that. And that when you look at certain topics, you're like, oh, wait a second. Yeah, it might seem like it's a good idea to just say no to this because it seems like that's all God's saying, but the fallout of that decision is going to do these negative things that God would not call us to. Mm-hmm. Ah, that stinks, because now what it means is I have to be way more intentional in thinking through how does my everyday interaction impact other people? Mm-hmm. And how am I, you know, we're called temples. Like God is inhabiting me right now. He is bringing Eden to people, hopefully. And so I ask a friend of mine always asks this question. And so now it's kind of in my head is, am I good news to the people around me when I'm bringing God's presence? Am I good news to them or not? And I think another thing with it is, so I'll do another nerdy, fun little Genesis bit. So the whole idea of, like when we talk about sin, I think sin has become this philosophical word that non-Christians have no idea what the heck we're talking about. So they've checked out a long time ago. But even I think a lot of times, again, in my faith tradition, what happens is kids are raised to learn the right and wrong answers for what different theological words mean. And then they pass the test. Huzzah. They get to stand up in front of the congregation and say they passed the test. Yay. But then it becomes a word that is like has no place in their everyday life. And I think sin is one of those. Whereas when I read the Old Testament, sin is this whole idea of I get to decide what's good and bad. I get to decide to be the one that defines what is good and bad. And 99 times out of 100, my way of defining it benefits me. And so you read all these stories and, you know, I don't call it sin because I look at the story of David and Bathsheba and I'm like, ah, so he rapes Bathsheba because it's what's good for him. And that's what he desires. And if I understand that, that like, oh, it's not just David sinned. It's that David chose to do what was best for himself in a way that totally ruins and devastates another human being. Mm-hmm. Or I then have to ask myself, well, how often do I do that?
Yeah.
How often do I rig the system to benefit me?
Yeah.
How often am I actually the Pharaoh in the story? I like to pretend like I'm always the oppressed and enslaved Israelites, but I'm Pharaoh a lot, where I rig it so that everybody is to benefit me. Mm-hmm. Well, now all of a sudden I can't check a box that says, did I do that one sin today? Nope, I'm good. Mm-hmm. I have to ask myself today, when did I choose to benefit me at the cost of someone else? Hmm. When did I make me the Pharaoh in the situation and everybody bow down to me? Hmm. Well, A, that's really hard because now all of a sudden I'm convicted regularly because I'm a mom and I'm a teacher, two places that are very easy to become Pharaoh. and I just honest. But now that kind of helps me to then in the moment say, what would be the thing here that would be for their benefit? Where has God called me to take care of them? So I had a student who, after class, I clearly blew his mind when we were talking about the word for man is Adam, and it can mean humanity or a man, or apparently that guy's name, but in Hebrew, it's just the same word over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And he was like, wait, what? So we talked, he's like, can we talk for a little bit? And we got done and we were talking, it was also about Sabbath. And he said, I don't understand how you knowing what the Sabbath means changes your life. Because do you celebrate Sabbath? And I was like, kind of want to. Like my husband and I have thought about like, I want to practice Sabbath a little bit more. But I said, here's what happens. You asked to talk to me. And the reality is I need to go pick up my kids from school. And he was like, oh my goodness, I'm so sorry. And I was like, oh, no. I have plenty of time to get there. I just wanted to get there early so I could sit in my car and play a game on my phone. That's the reality. That's what I wanted to do. And so when you asked me to stay, I had to say, but I really want to play that game on my phone. And instead I went, oh, no, he needs this. God has given us this time. God has given us time in order to be a blessing to others. I'm going to give you that time. And he was like, oh, that does change things. And it really does. And I was like, just so you know, most of the time I just pretend like I have something really important and then I blow you off because I'm a horrible human being just like you. But I do think that is, it's way harder to be a Christian if you understand how complex this life is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost easier to believe that just every day God puts me in front of him and says, you're guilty. Don't worry. I forgave you. Move on. And that's true. It is true that I am guilty and that he forgives me, but that kind of takes away any desire to try to, it's not be good. It's just trying to live the way that God has called us to in order to benefit the people that he's called us to inhabit this place with.
Yeah. And it also takes away, you know, the art that is trying to figure out what it means to live in faith.
And lest anyone accuse me from my faith tradition, the reality is I only can do this because the Spirit is in me. And I only can do this because I believe God is working through the Word and I believe the Spirit works through the Word. And I also screw it up all the time. It's not that I'm okay that I screw it up, but I know I'm forgiven to go try it again. Like I'm so freed. And I feel like there's so many Christians out there that because they have that guilty mindset, even though they've been told they're forgiven, they still feel guilty all the time and there's no freedom. And like with the sun sets free has been free indeed. Like I am free. And it's free to love people and I'm free to care for people and I'm free to keep trying to do this.
So Sarah, if someone wanted to start studying the Old Testament, where should they begin?
Genesis.
So like literally at the beginning.
Yeah. Genesis 1-3, it's so good. And it's when I get done, don't tell my students this, but when we get done with our like 7 weeks of reading Genesis 1-3, we literally read the same passages every day. But I get like, we get a new lens through which we're going to view it. So today, for fun, we watch the ancient Near East like creation accounts. So we watch like the Babylonian and the Egyptian, and the Egyptian one is fun. That involves something that not everyone on this listening to this podcast is okay with. But there is a, like, we watch all these different ones, and then we talk about like, what do these people believe about their God? And then like, especially the Babylonian one. And then we read the Genesis account, like, wait a second, some of these sound similar, and they freak out. It's really fun. But after we get done doing our whole, all of these 7 weeks, I just make them say, if you know anything else after this, ignore it. Like, I just want you to think about these three chapters. And I make them create a list of what do you believe about God just from these opening chapters. And every time they do it, like, I'm reduced to tears, because their image of God in the Old Testament is this God, or at least in these stories, is this God who is like a protector, a God who is so loving. Like, I love when they tell me like, he loves humanity, but he likes humanity, because that's so different. And it's so beautiful for them to like say that and express it out loud, that he's forgiving and he's patient and he's just it, like their image. And I always ask them, is that how you view God in the Old Testament? And they all say no. And I just tell them, like, then keep coming back to these passages. Anytime that you read a story in the Old Testament where you think God is not that list that you just made me, go back and read it again, because that's who he is. That's his character on full display. And I think the other cool thing is there's all these stories where they're just riffing on that, right? Cain and Abel is just the story of Adam and Eve. Like, he sees, he takes, right? Like, it's all the same story. So is David and Bathsheba. So is Abram and Hagar. Like, they're all the same story. And so most of what I found when I read the rest of scriptures, anything that there's like a connection to, it's always back to Genesis 1-3. Mm-hmm. And so read it as many times as it's, I mean, I can't say as interesting to you, because then you'll never move on. But read it until you feel like you have a grasp of those themes and those, kind of visuals, because Hebrew does a lot of those just word, like almost like an Easter egg, right? Like, they'll plant a word in a later story that's making you think of that. But I say go straight through, and any story you think is random or weird or out of place, spend more time there, because there is something there. I did that with the Abraham and Abimelech story. I always thought that story was so weird and random, and I'd always skip it. And then now I read it, and I'm like, oh my goodness, God made a mini Eden and was a blessing to the nations with this story. Like, they're supposed to have war and now they have peace. Like, what is going on? That's not a random story. Let's read that one again. Zipporah.
Yeah.
She circumcises her son and then rubs the bloody foreskin on her kids, on her husband's feet. And you're like, what? And then you read it over and you're like, oh, cool. God just used like blood to identify his people. It's so good. It's so random.
Sarah, I'm so thankful for not only your wisdom and your knowledge, but your passion and your joy that you bring to this topic. Thanks for spending time with us today.
Can I add one more thing though, to make it simple? Talk about it with people. That's another big thing. God didn't give us the church. He's always been about corporate worship. He's always been about corporate gatherings. He didn't give us the church for us to sit by ourselves. So if you ever feel like, I don't get this, go talk to somebody. And it could be somebody you feel like knows more about it or is at the same level as you. It could be a kid. I don't care who it is, but have the conversations together, because God's people have been growing in community since the beginning. And this scripture, the Hebrew Bible, was something that everybody collectively gathered around to understand. And so if there's anything that I can say to make it simple, it's do this together, do it with others.
Well, I don't know how she did it, but she did it. She broke down the Old Testament for us. And I feel like I have a, you know, I'm a pastor. I've got a good understanding of the Old Testament already in hand. I feel like I've grasped it, at least I should. But Sarah gave me some ways to think about it, or ways to communicate that understanding that, you know, I really hadn't heard before, or ways for us to reflect on it personally. That I really hadn't thought of before. So I'm really thankful for her insight, really thankful for her take on things.
Yeah, and how fun is she? I mean, I love the conversations where it's like you're talking with a friend, but I thought, man, I wish I'd had a teacher like her when I was in high school. Like, just how fun. And again, she's so excited about it, and she has a passion for the Old Testament that's just really sweet and beautiful, and it just comes through. Like, I mean, she was just delightful.
Yeah, I really am grateful on behalf of her students that they get to learn about the scriptures with her, because, man, is she just a wonderful personality, and also just a great scholar of the word. I appreciated, just to summarize some of the things I really appreciated in that conversation, I was thankful for how she reminded us that really the Old Testament, and really the whole Bible, is really just one story repeated over and over and over again. Yep. You know, yes, it's 66 books in total, 39 in the Old, 27 in the New, but it's really just one big story with a whole bunch of other stories supporting it and repeating that pattern over and over again. And I also appreciated how she said, look, we can come at this from many different angles, all of which are correct, but the most helpful angle for her in understanding the Old Testament is God's desire to be with humanity at tremendous cost to himself. Like, that's a great way to frame the message of the Old Testament that I think people can really resonate and understand and kind of carry with them as they dig through these 39 books.
You know, and as I was listening to her talk, something really clicked with me that I think God's been working on, but she articulated it and it fell into place for me. It's this idea that a lot of times we as Christians take the Old Testament and we look for those black and white things. This is what God said about this. This is what he says about this. Here's how this is what puts me on the right side of history, or these things. And we as Christians politicize things that are in scripture, or we look for scripture to help us with our political viewpoints or just how we navigate the day. And she said, you know, look past all that. And what does the Old Testament tell you about the character of God? That's what matters. That other stuff, it's just so much more gray than we think it is, or that we want it to be, because black and white feels much more comfortable than the gray things. But she's like, you know, it's not meant to be legalistic. And this idea that the God of the Old Testament was all about legalism and the rights and the wrongs, and this is sin and justice. And, you know, like, just the beauty of God's character. What does the Old Testament tell us about God's character? And that should be what you measure things against. And it really hit me in the feels when she was talking about that.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of being hit in the feels, you know, her emotion was on display in the interview itself, where she talked about, you know, how an understanding of the Bible comes to life in the hearts and minds of her students, and just how powerful that is for her to be able to be a part of and for her to see. And I thought that was really, meaningful. I thought that I was really touched when I saw her emotion. I mean, she obviously cares so deeply about the students that she serves, and she cares so deeply about this, this life-giving and life-changing text. And I was just, I was really encouraged to see her heart on display in that vulnerable moment in the interview. I don't know if it came across in audio, but certainly just, you know, being able to see her get emotional was really, really powerful for me. And I'm with you. I think one of the most helpful things she said is that we get to see the character of God on display in the earliest chapters of the Old Testament, Genesis 1-3. She hit that over and over again. We see the character and the heart and the nature of God on display in those first three chapters. But then really in the whole Old Testament, we get to see the heart of God at work. And we can't take moments in isolation. We have to understand every little strange thing we read in the Old Testament in light of that overarching picture that's painted of a God who longs to be with his people, who loves people, who doesn't just like humanity, who doesn't just love humanity rather, but actually likes humanity and wants to be with them. We have to understand it through that. And we do get that in the Old Testament. We get it as early as the first three chapters of Genesis.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. In my homeschool with my kids, we were learning the story of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and like those early fathers of our religion. And it's funny because just today we were talking about the story where God calls Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. And my kids, who are 9 and 6, were like, what? That's bonkers. Yeah. And I was like, no, it is crazy. I know. I don't really know what to do with this story. It's a weird one. And we were moving through it and we're doing very high level. And like listening to her talk made me think, gosh, I'll get emotional again. Like, I need to go back to it. I need to sit with it and say, what does this story tell us about the character of God, and show that to my kids? Because yeah, there are some bonkers stories that just don't make sense. One, because I'm a Christian in 2011, you know, or 2021. What year is it? 2021.
Yes, 2021.
I'm a Christian today, and I don't know the history and the context and those things. I don't know the context in which all that is. And so that's why it's good to dig in and learn and find out, because it does tell you more about the character of God when you take the time to do that. So I was just today thinking about an experience I had where I was like, okay, I'm encouraged to go back and go, I know this story is weird and it feels icky and I don't know what it tells us about God, but I should find out, knowing what I know about his character, what does this mean for me today as I talk to my kids?
That's right. That's right. And you know, what we see throughout the whole of the Old Testament, talking about that particular moment in history that captured in the Old Testament, what we know is that God desires a relationship with Abraham. What we know is that that's a picture that points us toward the person of Jesus Christ. What we know is that that's one, yet another story of God's desire to be with his people at great cost to himself, and that God will ultimately always provide the sacrifice that allows us to be his people. He provided it in the ram in that moment. He provided it in his son on the cross of Jesus Christ. That's the point. And you know, I appreciated how she said, and as a pastor, I tell this to our people as we study the scriptures all the time, you can't understand the New Testament apart from the Old, and you certainly can't understand Jesus and all the things he's saying to us apart from an understanding of the Old Testament. It's really essential. If you say you want to be all about Jesus, if you say even you want to just focus on the New Testament, well, you can't do those things apart from understanding these 39 books and the message that's found in them that all came before Christ.
Right. You know, and she also talked about asking yourself the introspection of, when have I chosen to benefit myself at the cost of somebody else? Yeah. And like the conviction that brought, and what a beautiful way to look at my role as a Christian. And I was like, this came out of this idea of, so when did I choose to benefit myself at the cost of somebody else? And how can I be more like Christ by benefiting others? That came just from talking about the Old Testament. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, we weren't even looking at scripture and dissecting it and leading to that. We're just having a conversation about the Old Testament. And I was led back to a place of conviction and just joy and a new way to look at how I navigate the world. I mean, that's so cool.
Yeah. And it was, you know, it was in the context of her giving an example of how a knowledge of the Old Testament has practical value for followers of Jesus today, because what it gives you the opportunity to do is when you know the overarching story that's at work, the story that's repeated over and over in the Old Testament, when you know the character of God, you're able to read those stories, to look at that history that's captured there, and then reflect on it in a way that has real impact to your faith and your everyday life, and say, well, look, man, I know at times I'm not just always the rescued people from Egypt. Sometimes I'm the Pharaoh. Mm-hmm. How have I been the Pharaoh? And or how have I not been the victim in the case of Bathsheba? How am I been the one who does the victimizing in the in the case of David? Boy, that's powerful application and deep reflection right there. And so I'm really thankful for how she invited us to use the Old Testament text as a way to reflect on our own need for the grace and mercy of God.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, things around us are messy and complicated. And that's why we're trying to do this podcast, to talk about these things. But I just really left this conversation with like, man, you can just, if you can take things back to the character of God, how much freedom, and like you build on it and go from there. But the Old Testament is complicated and there's a lot of crazy stuff in there. So even Sarah challenged you. How do you make she's waiting to hear from you. How do you make the Old Testament simple? Now it's your turn. How do you leave somebody? What do we think? What do we do with this Old Testament, these old scriptures?
I don't believe that we can make the Old Testament as a whole simple, but I do think we can simplify our understanding of what God is trying to do in the Old Testament. He's trying to show us how he loves us. He's inviting us into the story of his perpetual pursuit of humanity. And he's trying to lead us towards Jesus. And he's doing it through things that we can really, he's doing it through things we love. We love stories. We understand stories. We understand history. We understand narrative. And so he's inviting us into these sometimes insane stories, but at all times, he's inviting us to know his heart, to look for Christ, and to apply it to our own lives and understand that God has been, since the beginning of time, in pursuit of his people through whatever means necessary and also at great cost to himself, and that ultimately that's fulfilled in Christ. But that pursuit never ends. God is always and every day pursuing each one of us. That's what God's up to in all of his word, but that's what he's up to in the Old Testament too. He wants you to know his heart. He wants you to know that he's pursuing humanity relentlessly, and he wants you to know the person of Christ. That's what it's all about.
That's so beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. And we wouldn't have gotten there without our friend, Sarah Salzberg.
Yeah.
So this was great. Great conversation. I'm so thankful that you and I get to do this together, Rachel.
Oh, me too. I left me with so much to think about. This was a really special one.
Same. It's a good episode. Good fun. I'm going to go read Genesis 1-3 now. That's what I'm
going to do. Yeah, no kidding. All right.
Thanks for helping us make it simple. The show is produced by MPM. Our editor is Marcia Lambeth. Artwork for the show was designed by Brenton Little. Do you have a topic you'd like us to tackle or an expert you'd like us to chat with? Send your ideas to info@mattpopovitz.com. That's info@mattpopovitz.com. And if you'd like more information about Make It Simple or MPM, just head to mattpopovitz.com.